Are you ready, Alabama?
Hello? Who's there? What's going on?
You're listening to Hour Number 2 in the Doghouse.
Whatever's happening here, just knock it off.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
These kids are weird, man. They're weird.
Live from the Big Dog Production Studios.
I don't.
It's the Tom Abraham Show.
That might be listed in Revelations as the cause for the apocalypse.
Here he is, the head of the household, the Big Dog.
You're the smartest guy I've ever met.
Tom Abraham.
You want me to do this crap?
I guess I'm on here. Am I on? Can somebody respond?
All right, welcome back. Hour number two, the Tom Abraham Show here on a Reaction Monday in a Doghouse. Decent amount of U.S. Open talk to get things started. And joining us now from CBS Sports Radio, 9 to noon Eastern Time, 8 to 11 Central Time, the one and only Damon Amendola. D.A., welcome in. How are you, man?
Thank you, Big Dog. Happy belated Father's Day to you. All nine of your kids, I hope you got the happy birthday or the Father's Day wish, rather. And so basically it was like a food pantry line or something like that. Like everybody has to come see the Pope to say happy Father's Day.
Yeah, and it's almost like a little bit of a stay away type of deal. They're like, they know that I like to just totally chill on Father's Day. It always comes after a big fishing tournament that I have Father's Day weekend every year. But they all weigh in via the text message. I think they kind of make a little bit of a race out of it to see who gets in first. And so everybody's sending me text message notes and cards. And then my sons-in-law, who I also wish happy Father's Day to, my sons-in-laws all get in on the act as well. And they send me rude and funny little e-cards. So, you know,
nice.
It's good. Oh, no, I got some really good ones. I mean, they were pretty good. And, you know, it was good stuff, man.
That's great. There's like 14 people you have wishing you happy Father's Day. That's a pretty amazing number right there.
Yeah, well, all nine kids got in, of course, and then about five or six, you know, most of the grandkids that can talk, you know, they weigh in as well, you know, so they don't understand what they're saying. Their parents tell them, go over there to Pappy and say happy Father's Day to Pappy. You know, and they're like, what are you talking about? He's not my father. But, you know, they get it. They understand it.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing. So happy belated to you.
Yeah, thanks. Another tradition, of course, is the it seems that the U.S. Open often falls on Father's Day. And, you know, it's a chill. I always hope that it rains that day in my neck of the woods because – otherwise, you feel guilty, you know what I mean? Sitting inside. It's what I love about the British Open is that it's over with by like 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, you can watch it early in the morning if you want to check that out. But, yeah, it doesn't have the juice that the Masters has because the Masters, everybody's, you know, kind of just starting to really get into the golf season. It kind of kicks things off. But it's the U.S. Open, and you almost kind of feel obligated to stay on top of it.
Yeah, here in New York, we had the most miserable spring. I mean, April was rainy and cold. May was rainy and cold. Early June was just starting to tip, and everybody was getting real antsy. And then this past weekend, at least Sunday, was beautiful for most parts of the Northeast over here. So at least for me, I was spending it outside with my dad. I always get roped into doing, like, yard work for him. So, you know, we had to like, clean everything and do all the patio furniture and everything and clean the grill off and stuff like that. So I was outside with him, so I didn't watch much yesterday. But I did follow it over the course of the weekend. And, I mean, the big thing that you take away is just that it is so awkward when Fox does the broadcast. I don't think this will ever feel natural, Fox doing golf. It just doesn't fit the right tone.
Yeah, everything is different with them. I don't think you could just do one thing and be any good at it. And, you know, I remember when Pat Summerall was the voice of the NFL, basically, and when he did the Masters and he did other golf, it sounded right. Joe Buck, not so much. And then for him to end it on this moment, we've been talking about this a little bit today, but for him to end it with this little gem.
His girlfriend, Becky Edwards, All-American soccer player at Florida State.
Joe, that's actually his new girlfriend. That's Jenna Sims. They're all staying together this week.
Ouch. I mean, really? Ouch! To go down that path, and I don't even know if you're Paul Azinger who corrects him there. Do you correct the play-by-play guy there? Or do you let it twist in a win? How does the girlfriend feel about it? I mean, that was just awkward beyond awkward.
Yeah, I mean, think about how many layers of awkward this is. As you mentioned, I mean, it just looks bad for Joe Buck because he misidentifies a person. I mean, you know, I think if you're the color guy, if you're Azinger, you do have to correct him because you don't want to just leave it obviously incorrect hanging out there. I think it's very awkward for the girl involved. I mean, that now you're being talked about as the ex-girlfriend. That's a bad look. But for Joe, I mean, it's partially on research. Don't get me wrong. All these guys are supposed to have spotters, and this is who you're looking at, and the directors and everything. This is who we got on camera. But for Joe also, man, if you're gonna do that, you better get it right. Like, we don't really need to know background about his girlfriend. Nobody really needs to care about, you know, necessarily her, like, resume. So if you're going to do it, you better nail it. Because, yeah. Like, when we see Ayesha Curry in the NBA Finals, Mike Breen's not giving us a breakdown of who Ayesha Curry was. So you kind of have to make sure you get it right if you're going to bother talking about that person.
Yeah, and then the weirdest, too, at the very end there, when they're all staying together. What does that mean? Who's all? I mean, he's got the ex and the current girlfriend. Who is the that they're all staying together this weekend? I mean, it's just kind of weird, but it's good to see an athlete. I mean, this is an ex-baseball player in Brooks Koepka. You can tell that he obviously takes care of himself. He's in great shape, and, you know, that's still the Tiger effect. I still think we're seeing the Tiger effect on this generation of golfers, guys that are in shape that play golf.
Yeah, I would agree, although two things stood out to me yesterday's final leaderboard and what it looked like. The top five names over there, I mean, most golf fans, I mean, you'd have to be a pretty hardcore golf fan to know all five of those guys. I think also most casual fans are like, huh? Who? What are we talking about? There's no Rory. There's no Tiger. There's no Phil. There's no Dustin. There's no Jason Day. There's no none of the guys that I know is on here. And that's got to be a little worrisome for the final day of a U.S. Open. But also, this is the seventh straight major that was won by a first-time winner. And, you know, it kind of makes it feel now that winning a major is just for the Johnny-come-latelys. And that's a weird thing for golf, that after the dominance of Tiger, to not have guys that you've heard of challenging on the back nine on Sunday, but also just to have this two-year series where it's like basically rookies winning, you know, rookies winning every award in the game. I mean, it's just kind of it's not dynamic.
Well, it's not that they're even not having multiple, you know, winners, Jordan Spieth, Jason Day, and, you know, Dustin Johnson, these kind of guys, Rory, who's kind of fallen off quite a bit. It's not that they're not winning multiple. They're missing the cut. I mean, Tiger and Jack never missed the cut. I fully expected, to be honest with you, after the top three players in the world missed the cut on Friday, I fully expected that Fox would, like, move this to FS1 or put it on, you know, the Fox movie channel or something like that. I mean, I had to be sitting there thinking, are you kidding me? And I still don't know who some of those guys, and I do follow golf, and they're like, who are these people? If it wasn't that Justin Thomas was a Crimson Tider, you know what I mean? That was something to follow down in our neck of the woods. So you're following that guy for that. But, you know, I don't know who a lot of these guys were that were in the top 20, much less the top five.
Yeah, so it's the opposite Tiger effect.
Yeah.
You're right. It has developed younger guys who stay in shape, that don't look like your dad, that don't look like a normal golfer used to be. So they're more athletic. They're younger. They're kind of more of they're better prepared to have success early. But at the same time, there's no dominance whatsoever. And when guys like you're talking about Jordan Spieth and Rory and Jason and all these other guys, Dustin Johnson, when they're not in the mix, it really shows this like incredible lack of star power that golf has right now, because Tiger's obviously gone and Phil is like, will he, won't he, you know, he's getting up there in age. You can't really count on him for too much longer for majors. So it's a very odd time to me in golf. It might be even though we've got Jordan Spieth and even though we've got some marketable guys, it feels like an in-between bubble right now.
Yeah, exactly. Damon Amendola with us, CBS Sports Radio. All right, let's move on to another big story from over the weekend, that the Paul George telling the Indiana Pacers that he's gonzo after next year, which is a really odd thing, which means go ahead and trade me now, I guess. And not only is he gonzo, he makes it sound like he knows where he's going. I'm going to the Lakers. Really? I mean, is that just an automatic thing? I don't know. A lot of conversation, though, about Paul George to Cleveland and the Cavaliers. And the only way that happens is probably in a trade for Kevin Love, which is a front court guy for a back court guy. I mean, would the Cavs be that much better? Forget about the regular season and the playoffs. Would they be that much better to compete with the Warriors if you have Paul George in place of Kevin Love, or is it a bit of a wash in a way?
I think they're better. I think they're better if they add Paul George, because Paul George, I think, can be a better third option scorer than Kevin Love. And I think most importantly, he can be a lockdown defender. He can be your primary defender. So if you tackle a team like the Warriors, or you tackle a team like the Spurs with Kawhi or whatever that's going to be in the NBA Finals, you can put Paul George on their best offensive weapon, and then that alleviates pressure off of LeBron. And then Kyrie is not really all that good defensively, so it helps you out there. And let's face it, in the NBA Finals, one of the biggest problems with the Cavs was that they simply couldn't get stops when they absolutely needed it. That, I mean, you look at the point totals that the Warriors had in those five games, it was obnoxious. So, and they were outside of the top 10 defensive efficiency all season long, and no NBA champion's ever been that, or at least not in a long time. So I think it makes them better. You definitely have to ask the question, would it make them much better if you've got to trade away Kevin Love? The most important question, though, is even if the Cavs wanted to do it, do they have enough to give away? I mean, they can trade Kevin Love, but are the Indiana Pacers going to take back Kevin Love and then nothing else to give away their franchise? Because the Cavs don't have draft picks. They've traded all of those away. They don't have young players. They don't have young assets. They don't have anything anybody would want besides Kevin Love. So I don't know if that's going to be enough to get it done. I assume that the Cavaliers won't have the best offer out to the Pacers at some point.
Yeah, well, and that may be the case when it comes right down to it, for sure. All right, finally, Major League Baseball. They gave us the powdering of the blue, or whatever you want to call it, for Father's Day weekend, and now it's extending to the entire weekend. We did pink for Mother's Day. We did camo for Memorial Day. We'll do red, white, and blue for 4th of July, and so on and so forth. They're doing something every holiday weekend. Does this – I mean, I don't want to beat it off my lawn, guy, but does it make any sense that I have now lost interest in watching the American pastime on holidays, which I so looked forward to in the past, because the teams are unrecognizable? We took the greatness of uniform and just completely homogenized the whole league, where everybody looks the same. Most of them look terrible. All of them look terrible. They don't match anything. These socks are absolutely ridiculous. They have actually pushed me away from baseball, and I don't believe that a bunch of 20-somethings tuned in to see the powder blue uniforms over the weekend. So they kind of like get rid of their main constituency, and they do nothing to help themselves. Am I lying here, or were you like, oh, I got to see this. I got to get me one of those caps.
No, I think they've watered it down by doing it so much. I think it's kind of become cliche now that you know that the jerseys are going to be ugly and the uniforms are going to be silly and themed around the holidays. And so I don't like it either. I think it's too much. My question is not, do I think it's attracting fans? My question is, how much money are they making to make this thing this worth it? That they're going to extend the teal or the blue for prostate cancer or Father's Day all weekend. That they're going to do 4th of July and Memorial Day, and then add on top of it Mother's Day and the pink. And, like, they have these theme things. And so what do we do? We did the camo for Memorial Day. I mean, it's just, it's so much. And every year it's so much that they must be making money hand over fist with these auction items. I mean, it's the only thing that I can figure. Like, Hunter Strickland's jersey was being auctioned off, and that's why everybody got all hot and bothered. But, like, why else would you do this? Because I don't ever see anybody walking around with any of these caps that they're – and I live in New York City where caps are a huge thing and everybody's fashionable and all that. I never see people wearing these themed Major League Baseball caps ever.
Yeah. Yeah, and now they've added this to coming up to Players Weekend, August 25th through 27th, 3 days. Players can wear nicknames on the back of their jerseys, which makes me remember think of Jesus Shuttleworth, right? Well, Ray Allen had the Jesus Shuttleworth jersey.
Or he hate me.
Or did he hate me thing. Now, I'll say this. If it's just that, you know, I could kind of see a Joey Bats jersey and things like that. Now, you got teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox, depending on if they're home or away, you know, they don't have their names on their jersey. So are we going to have Yankee? I bet we don't have names on the back of a Yankee uniform. I can't believe that they would do that. But they, I guess, are going to allow them to do other stuff, wear whatever color shoes and socks and everything else. And again, I don't know. I just don't know how this is going to work.
You know, yeah. Again, I don't know how it's going to work either. I just have to ask, like, how much money do they have to be making as a stream of revenue to make this all worth it? To make the entire league look ugly for an entire week, and how much of this revenue are they pulling in? Because it'd be one thing if they designed an annual hat where you knew, like, the one thing that I thought was okay was when the hat was original, just like the normal team, but the logo itself had the stars and stripes.
Love it. Okay, that was subtle
enough on the 4th of July or subtle enough on Memorial Day or whatever. If that was just what they did, fine. And that just became the new tradition, fine. If on Mother's Day they all wore pink stirrups or they all wore pink cleats, okay. You know, say, but it, all weekend, every part of the uniform, it's a dominating everything. Like, it's gotten to the point where this is so ridiculous. They must just be selling every last piece of the jersey to make some type of money on.
Yeah, you know, or even do something just with the umpires, or, you know, it started out very subtle. It started out with wristbands, right? Then they dipped the bats, you know, blue and pink for Father's Day and Mother's Day. But the wristbands were fine. You know, that was cool. The wristbands were cool. I mean, that was good. It's gotten out of control as usual. And I guess you would think that they must be making money. Why would you do it if you weren't making money?
Right, but I mean, for. So the Hunter Strickland thing, I think, brings it into focus because it became big news that they were selling on their auction website, here is the jersey that Hunter Strickland wore as he got into a fist fight. So, you know, baseball is going to suspend this guy for doing it, but then sell his jersey. So there's obviously hypocrisy there. But, you know, so are they going to sell Hunter Strickland's jersey and his hat and his pants and his glove or whatever, however many things there are, his cleats, and then do that for 25 guys times two in that game times every team. So there's 15 games played that day. So is that all of that money that I guess they're going to raise and say they're going to give to charities and stuff? Are they have to be taking part of that. So are they doing this so that every day they're basically auctioning off other items? Because this is a league that makes billions of dollars on television revenue. Like, it can't, you know, if you sell a jersey for $200 at an auction, I can't imagine that that's that big a deal. But, I mean, maybe it is if you're selling every little piece of the puzzle and you're selling it, you know, however much, and you're using it as kickbacks or something. I don't know. It's just weird that they're going so full into this.
All right. Finally, Yankees' magical, mystical ride is coming to an end here before we get to the 4th of July holiday. They've lost six straight. Boston has now caught them in the standings. They're in basically a virtual tie with the Red Sox. Terrible, terrible road trip. Guys getting hurt. Pitching is all banged up. Is this just going to be a fond memory for New York Yankee fans, or can they gather it up and continue down the stretch here and be a factor all the way through?
Yeah, I think their red hot start was, I thought it was an anomaly. I didn't think that was really who they were. They obviously had a great lineup. They have a great lineup. Aaron Judge has been absolutely sensational. But I always felt like they couldn't keep up that pace of the early predictions of them going to the World Series and stuff like that. It wasn't realistic. Everybody coming into the season knew that the Yankees were probably a 500 team. Maybe they could compete for a wild card, but certainly not much more than that. And when they started out of the chutes that red hot, I think it lulled people into a false sense of them being better than they were. Had they finished the season with that record, but finished the season at five games over 500, you know, I think that would feel like maybe what we would have expected. And they ended with a flourish, and they ended with the guys growing up. So I think this is more along who they are. I don't think that they're bad enough to lose four straight in Oakland or whatever to get swept in Oakland. I just think that they're closer to being a team that's going to have to fight and scratch and claw to be in the playoff race rather than the one that jumped out to a huge lead in the division.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting now to go back home. Best record in baseball at home, 22-9, but not as good a record as Houston has on the road, 23-8. That's the crazy thing. Houston's 23-16 at home. They're 23-8 on the road, so it seems like everybody's chasing them, at least in the American League anyway. All right, D.A., appreciate you as always. We're out of the box next week. We do our got my annual week in the mountains with the Junkyard Babe in the cabin. So we'll talk in a couple of weeks. We'll get hooked up probably 3 weeks now. Today. So we'll get hooked up probably all-star break weekend, somewhere right around there.
Okay, sounds good, big dog. Looking forward to it, man.
All right, man. Appreciate you. Thanks.
Okay, see you.
All right, there you go. Damon Amendola jumping in there and yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, he joins us on Monday, so next week I'm out of the box, and, you know, my annual summer vacation. Following week, Monday and Tuesday, we'll be still off that for the 4th of July holiday. Following Monday after that is SEC Media Days. So it'll be SEC Media Days July 10, 11, and 12 for us. We'll be there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Cole will be there through Thursday because the thing ends at noon on Thursday, so there's no reason for me to stand around. By the time Thursday at 2 o'clock comes, it'll be nothing but me and a guy with the vacuum cleaner making all kinds of noise, so I'll be back in studio for Thursday afternoon with a complete wrap-up of SEC Media Days. So that's kind of the way it goes now during this portion of the summer. And then when we get back after that, you know, the week of SEC Media Days, that's when pretty much it's on like Donkey Kong the rest of the way from there. All right, let's get a break. We'll come back with more right after this. Speaking of Colt Kublik, he's up next. It's the Tom Abraham Show right here on 730-1039. The Hump.
Read the sign. Beware of dog. Tom Abraham is back.
During the March Madness when we made that bet, Erky kept tacking on like extra things. That big dog has to use Cole's bump music. Cole would have had to use my bump music. Can you imagine that stuff bumping Cole? I think it could have happened. You never know. Cole Kublik joins us now. Cube, you could have used some of that stuff. You'd have liked a little bit of my bump music, wouldn't you? I mean, come on.
No, I'm sure some of it would have been okay. We would have made a little bit of it work.
Maybe. Could have made a little bit of it work. I'm stoked tomorrow. I haven't been to Dreamland in a long time, so I'm stoked tomorrow for Dreamland. And I even invited T-Mac, even though it's going to cost me even more. I invited T-Mac to come on down so we can make it a foursome. And you know, I'm fired up for this thing now tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. Did we decide on a time? I had said noon, and then I think Arky said noon 30 or something like that. Do we know what time we're supposed to meet over there?
12:30 would help me to be able to get a workout in, but if you desperately need to do it at 12, I can make that happen. So
no, 12:30 should be okay. I then have to go to Athens and do my show in the Colt Kublik studios and sit in the Colt Kublik chair and use the Colt Kublik mic. So I'm just a little bit nervous about being, you know, crunched for time there. They got internet and stuff there, don't they? I mean, will I be able to get hooked up?
Sometimes.
I'm going to do a remote. I'm going to go upstairs to my old office upstairs now next to Steve's office, and I'm going to just do a remote from upstairs. Would that count, or do I actually have to sit in your chair for it to count?
If you can get away with completing any project upstairs at that place, I'll be impressed.
Yeah, they might not have dark technology up there to get me hooked up.
In the dark, unfriendly confines, dusty with mold and, yeah.
It used to be so vibrant. I mean, can you imagine 13 salespeople and all kinds of bosses and everything up there? And you know, we even had people. We had training going on the third level. I mean, it was really vibrant back in the day there, man. I mean, can you even imagine? Or like the ghosts of people past, you know, bumping around. A couple of different people at the front desk and stuff, handling the front desk duties and all that good stuff.
Walk up to the third floor and tell me if you don't think that place is haunted when you're there tomorrow.
I need to do that. I haven't been up to the third floor in a long – I bet I haven't been on the third floor in 10 years. We used to have our
staff meetings. Pretty creepy up there.
Isn't? We used to have our staff meetings up there. At one point in time, I think for a minute, my office was up there. And then I moved down, then I moved down again, and if I got any lower, I'd be beneath the basement there. But in any event. Now, listen, you caught some fish on Saturday at the TOC event, the wonderful event that TOC puts on. And it wasn't a drum. You didn't like sideswipe a drum. So you caught some bass. Any interest in a little bit? You know, I mean, might you fill in any of the dates between now and the next TOC event to do a little more fishing, or is that once a year enough for you?
Jason Simpson, meteorologist at Channel 19, mm-hmm. tweeted at me Saturday during the day when he saw that a fish I posted that I caught and said we might need to get him involved in our fishing tournament that benefits Children's Hospital down in Birmingham. And I said, I'll go ahead and commit to it and cap it at 2. And that's it. 2 days a year, I'll go fish. And that's it. No more. That's it. It's over. I will fish 2 days a year. And yes, I will double it from what it has been the last few years at 1 and make it 2.
Yeah, but isn't that a great feeling? I mean, when I don't even know what you caught that thing on. I don't know if you were hopping a jig or swimming a spoon or what you were doing when you caught that fish. But it was a worm. I mean, when you get that
rubber worm.
No, it's a plastic worm. It's not a rubber worm. It's been a rubber worm since 1964. It's a plastic worm. And when you hop that thing a couple of times, and then all of a sudden you feel that tap tap, and then you step back and you cross his eyes. I mean, isn't that a rush, man? Is that better than hitting a 200 yard 5-iron to within 10 feet?
No, definitely not. You know, the first 2 hours we were out there were great. It was a little overcast.
Yeah.
Sun didn't really get to come out through the clouds. It was a little breeze. It was nice. But boy, I tell you, from about 10:45 to noon, that's you had no desire really to be out there anymore. With the gnats and the heat and the humidity, it was gross.
There was no wind. They were pulling no, you know, there was no current in the water at all. It was a grind. I'll admit it was a grind. And I've often wondered why they do that Father's Day weekend. Why they don't move it to May. You know, to me, it would be better early May, but, you know, I get that. But it is, you get that a lot of times with that heat. Well, what did you end up, I mean, they put on a wonderful event. The TOC's tremendous folks. They put on a wonderful event there. Jeff Berschreker, who's a big Auburn fan, does a great job. I didn't see you after I went in and out of the prize tent and came out of there with it. There was all this beautiful stuff in there, all these $200 reels, which I could really use a 15th reel. And ultimately, I ended up coming out of there with a shop vac because my wife had reminded me that we needed a shop vac, and that's what I came out of there with. But there was some Auburn memorabilia there and stuff. What did you end up coming out of there with?
I got a gift certificate to Connor's to take the wife out to dinner. So, yeah, all that cool stuff you were talking about, we got picked probably in like the last 10 teams. So it was all
gone. Oh, that's
bad.
Yeah, that's bad. You know, it was unusually early for us. Keith on a tractor says, ha ha, the old rubber worm Cole was using. That's a good job by Keith.
Yeah, we had a purple rubber worm, and then we put a white rubber worm on there, and I think we had a yellow one later. So it was, yeah.
They haven't been rubber worms in a long time. I'm just
saying.
What,
a silicone?
They're plastic, man. It's kind of a plastic.
Feels like rubber.
It does kind of feel like rubber. There's no question about it. Cole Kubelik with us from the morning show. I only have 8 shows before SEC Media Days. I mean, it's going to be on us in a hurry this year.
Are you taking a month off?
No, I got a week off next week. I got my week off. I take a week off in the summer. You know, I get my week off next week. So I have 5 shows this week, and then I have that week off, and then we're off Monday and Tuesday because of 4th of July. So then I come back Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So I've got 5 shows this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Cole, it's July 10th. I mean, my gosh,
yeah.
July 10th this year. It's so early.
I gotta go. I gotta go all this week and all next week, and then I'm taking that Wednesday of July 4th. So that'll be a short week before Media Days. But yeah, it feels like it's still a long way away for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it won't be, though. I mean, it's going to be on top of us in a hurry, and a lot of this has to do too with the fact that a lot of camps will be opening earlier because of no more double sessions, and so now you get the same number of practices. It's stretched out over a little bit longer period of time. you know, what do you think about that? I mean, would you rather see, you know, 20 practices in 20 days, or do you like to see 20 practices in 12 days? Is there a value to a double session to you?
I think so. I think it helps you physically get acclimated to what you're going to do. And I think what it does to me is it helps the coach separate your learning periods and, well, you're learning the playbook and learning the fundamentals from learning what it's going to take physically to be an SEC football player. Mm-hmm. And usually in the two-a-day, one of those practices is more of a mental practice. And that'll usually be also your conditioning practice, as in more conditioning when it's over. And then the later practice is your physical practice. You're going to go middle drill, Oklahoma. You're going to go full speed pass rush. You're going to go team on team. So that's usually what you get in the second practice. And I think now you're going to have to combine those two. You mentioned spreading it out. I don't think the coaches really have a choice but to spread it out because they can't do two-a-days anymore. So
right. They
have to spread it out. And for me, it's the continuing softening of college football players. And I think as a result, we'll probably see more guys injured early in the season. We'll see teams playing sloppier football early in the season. Tackling won't be as good just because I don't think it's going to be as easy. Coaches are going to be more concerned with learning first, in my opinion. And I think the physical aspect will come second because coaches, if you're playing younger guys, the first thing that they have to know is what to do. They need to know their assignments, and then you want to work them fundamentally, where to line up, what the terminology is going to be, things of that nature, where to be on certain throws, routes, blocking schemes, whatnot. And I think the physical part's going to come second. That sounds crazy, but I just think if a coach is worried about what he's putting on the field, he at least wants guys out there first that know what they're doing. So it'll continue to take away from the physical aspect of this game. And I would expect, just like early last year, when first 3 weeks of the season, I didn't see any good offensive line play. We saw poor tackling across the board. I would expect that to continue this year.
Yeah, it's the old, you got to practice football to play football, and we don't practice very much football anymore with the limitations on contact and things like that. I would think from a player standpoint, it will get so tedious, to be able to at least have a skull session and a field session and to do something like that and kind of fill those days up of camp. There seems to be, there's going to be a lot of dead time. It's not like you got one practice a day, a meeting a day, and a practice a day like you do during the season, and you're going to class. There's no class. So it seems like more dead time. I wonder if the flip side of all of this, what you're talking about, the way football looks early on in the season especially, this is the only level of football, college football, NCAA college football, the only level of football where there's no scrimmage against another team. Nothing allowed. At the high schools, they do jamborees. At the NFL, they got the preseason. At the little kids' football, they have jamborees. They have little, where you get to scrimmage against other people. What would be the harm, if you will, in somehow having some sort of a jamboree-type thing or scrimmage against another team midway through this longer camp now where you could really evaluate against somebody else, even if it's a FBS or it's somebody that's totally not on your scale. You know what I mean? You know, would that be a value to these guys?
I mean, physically on the field, yeah, it would. But this is also the only level of football in which the champion ultimately is determined on by perception. Now, I understand right. There's a playoff and those teams play for a title, but those teams are still selected by a committee to get in to go play in that title game. You don't play your way in, per se. So I think that if Alabama scrimmaged College of Charleston and Saban sent all his first team guys and College of Charleston moved the ball, let's not even say they keep a score, but someone's there and they report that they're moving the ball up and down the field, well, all of a sudden, whether you like it or not, the perception of Alabama in the media changes. Maybe not completely, of course not completely, but people are going to point to that. People are going to think of that. They're going to remember that. And that is the biggest problem, in my opinion, is that these coaches don't want to show anything. You're going to get against players and teams that are going to be going at a different level, a different pace. What happens if you're scrimmaging North Dakota and their defensive end just blindsides Jared Stidham and takes him out and points the corner? How do you punish the defensive end for North Dakota? What happens to him?
Yeah.
It doesn't affect him the rest of the year. It doesn't affect their season. So I don't think what these coaches like most is that they control every aspect of their team until they get into a game, and I think they want to keep it that way.
Such a mystery, though, when you play. I just can't imagine it. I mean, it's such a mystery when you show up for that first game where you really haven't seen guys go against live competition and, you know, whether or not they are – you know, I wouldn't do them like preseason games. I'd do them like scrimmages. I'd do them with non-contact jerseys for quarterbacks and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. That's just me, Cole Kublik, with us here. I got Phil Steele coming up later on. I know you have a great deal of respect for Phil, because of the amount of work that he puts into his publication. And you're not going to find that in his publication the best food in the SEC and the best sideline attire by the cheerleaders and things like that. It's all hardcore football stuff. But From talking to Phil to setting this thing up, sounds like he's really, really high on Florida. And I don't mean just out of the SEC East. He's got Florida, his surprise team. Last year's surprise team was Washington. I know you've been looking at the electronic version of the magazine. He's got Florida as a surprise team in college football this year. Your reaction to that?
There are parts of me that believe they are a quarterback away. You know, Callaway and company, they're a legitimate receiver. They're loaded at running back with Thompson and Scarlett, and they have different style backs, so that helps. Tight end positions in great shape with Goolsby and those guys. They have pass catchers, they have blockers. The offensive line is probably the most talented in the SEC. Actually, I would say it is the most talented in the SEC. T.J. McCoy is the most physical center in the SEC. Juwan Taylor would probably be my second, at worst, third pick at tackle if we're drafting tackles in this league. Martez Ivey has all the ability in the world. He just hadn't put it together yet. The people saying they think he's going to be a first-round draft pick after this season are silly because he hadn't played great football. But the ability and talent is there up front. Defensively, linebacker's a bit of an issue. Secondary looks fine. Even though you lost a couple guys, they're still going to have dudes there. They had them last year. And I think Taven Bryan and Kari Clark and C.C. Jefferson are going to be just fine up front. That defensive line will not miss much of a beat. And they've lost big-name guys each the last 3 years. But the D-line is going to be just fine, and that's a great place to start. Now, Randy Shannon takes over as D coordinator. Jeff Collins, the head coach at Temple, so that changes things. But at least they have options at quarterback. And I think just quarterback consistency is going to be big for them. Because you look at what's happened to Mac his first few years. I mean, he catches fire with Will Grier. Things are rolling right along, and then he gets suspended. Del Rio looks like he's going to be able to manage things last year. He gets banged up, can't go. They got to turn it over to Appleby. So they haven't been able to find consistency at quarterback. I mean, he's had to go with a fifth-year with a graduate transfer from Purdue and a slot receiver the last 2 years, and he's won the East both times. So we know Mac can coach. If they can find a quarterback to just keep them in games, move the ball, understand field position. And by the way, they got one of the best kickers in college football, which I'm not big on talking about kickers, but Pinheiro is a weapon. And I think he's going to be every bit of what Daniel Carlson will be for Auburn this year. Of once you cross the 50, you got a chance at points. And that's a nice place to be as an offensive coordinator or play caller. So I like Florida right now in the East. They will be my East champion. Linebacker, offensive line depth, who the first five is going to be on the offensive line and quarterback will be my big question marks. Plus, look at that Florida schedule. There are some other SEC schedules that look a lot better than that one. I mean, opening up with Michigan, Florida State in the non-conference, they get LSU from the East. So it's not as nice looking to say a Kentucky schedule, that's for sure. Yeah. Maybe not even Tennessee with Georgia Tech, Alabama, LSU. I mean, they're not one of the easier schedules in the SEC East. So that's what I turn to. That's one of the reasons I think Kentucky finishes top three in the East. But Florida would be my pick right now.
When you say top three in the East, that puts Tennessee, I would think, in that four hole, I don't think Georgia slips that much because I think Georgia's defense brings back like 10 guys, and I think they're getting very, very good defensively with Kirby Smart and that crew there. But my question about Georgia is, I know you're not a huge fan of the work ethic of Jacob Eason. Is there any chance? I mean, read the tea leaves. You talk to guys all the time. Could Jake Fromm actually push for that starting job there? Could they actually hit? No? Okay.
I don't believe he can. I think this is all fabricated by the coaching staff, trying to get him to become more presidential, trying to get him to become a guy who takes more ownership of the position. But My concerns with Georgia are up front. You know, they're going to move some of the offensive linemen around. Isaiah Wynn and some other guys that played guard are going to try to kick to tackle. The advantage that they have is you got a solid group of tight ends that can help those tackles out in Blazevic and Isaac Nada. And you got a couple good running backs, really three, when you look at Elijah Holyfield also behind Michelle and Chubb. Receiver's going to be a bit of a problem. I think Ridley's going to be fine and can be a guy that makes plays for them, but I'm not real confident of that group as a whole. And here's the thing about Georgia's defense. They got a lot of dudes coming back, but other than Trent Thompson, there's no wow guys on that defense, none. I mean, Bellamy's okay. He's the guy that he makes a play every now and then, but I just don't see dudes on that defense that I'm like, whoa, I wouldn't want to have to block that guy, or that guy can take over a game. They just don't have them.
I think they got wild guys.
Lorenzo Carter's another one that's a five-star guy and people sort of pee their pants over, but I just don't see him making a ton of plays. So I think schematically, Kirby and that staff that has can help that group keep them in games and do some nice things, but that by no means is going to be a dominant defense. And look at the schedule. When you look at teams like Missouri, like Auburn, like South Carolina, if Georgia ends up getting in a shootout with teams like that, they're not going to be able to keep up. That's not how they're going to be built. And I think that's kind of across the board in the SEC this year. When you throw in Ole Miss and maybe even Arkansas with Austin Allen, what he's able to do, I think there's going to be a lot of teams that can score a lot of points but probably can't stop anybody. And if you don't make sure that you flip the style of play and make them play your kind of game, you could get caught. And we're going to see some upsets in the SEC this year because of that. And Georgia's one of those teams that I don't know if they'll be able to keep up with a team like that. And a couple of those teams could catch them slipping.
I think experience is, I mean, you're right, in terms of wild guys defensively, but they got wild guys with golf shirts on. And I think that those guys could take 10 experienced players that coming back that have earned letters and play some pretty good defense. I don't think a lot of people are going to have huge days offensively on them. But finally, though, I want to get your thought on this, because we won't talk for a little while with me being off the next couple of weeks early in the week. The SIDs put LSU ahead of Auburn in the West, and I'm a little bit, I mean, they're SIDs, I get that, but I don't want to be disrespectful to those guys. I'm a little bit miffed, though. LSU has something I don't know if I've ever seen before in the SEC. They've got five road games in the SEC because they had to play Florida at home last year, and a year they were circling the drain anyway. What about LSU with that schedule with five road games, only three home games in the league? Not a tough non-conference schedule, but SID's putting LSU ahead of Auburn. That was a little surprising. What do you think?
I think LSU has a couple guys that could make it really interesting for them. DJ Chark and those receivers are really good. I have no idea what to expect outside center where William Clapp's going to bump down on the offensive line. I'm not real high on KJ Malone at tackle. Defensively, Arden Key is a big-time difference maker. I mean, he could be the most – dominant impact player on that side of the football in college football. He has that kind of skill set. They lost a ton up front. I mean, they were as depleted as Florida or Alabama on the defensive line, with Godchow moving on, Lewis Neal moving on. You had both linebackers and Beckwith and Riley moving on. So it's going to be tough to replace, but I do like what Matt Canada does offensively. And I think a quarterback who's been around college football, who knows maybe how to control games, who has a guy like Darius Geis that he can lean on, makes LSU very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. The schedule's tough, like you mentioned. And do I think they're going to win the West? No. Can they challenge past midway through the season? Probably. But I think they're in a really good spot from a staff perspective, having Dave Aranda, who's great, Matt Canada, who's great, and to have Ed Orgeron as sort of your overseer, back into that CEO role, motivator type guy, instead of someone who's trying to control every aspect of the program. You know, you can go down with the D-line and with Pete Jenkins and yell at those guys and take his shirt off and go crazy. And, you know, he can come yell at the running backs if he wants to and run middle drill, whatever. But he doesn't have to be a guy that's diagnosing a game plan or calling a game. And I think that's a big advantage for them, especially with just emotionally what the program means to him. So I think they're in a good place from a staff perspective. Quarterback probably gets them beat two, three times. And they'll challenge. They'll be in it for a little while. But I think depth up front on both sides of the ball probably catch up to them later in the season. So I would probably have Auburn second in the West right now, but I don't think it's absurd to have LSU there because I think there's a pretty big drop-off in the West after those three.
Cole Kublik, catch him every morning, 6 bells right here on EM. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Let's get a break in here. It's Tom Abraham Show, 730-1039, the ump.
Now back to the big dog. This show is rough.
Just a good old boy.
Never think about old Mick Mixer.
Beats all you never saw.
I ask him for something, he puts it in there. Since the day they was born. I say, you know, why don't we have the Dukes of Hazzard in? Why don't we have Waylon Jennings in there in the mix anymore? He's like, done. McDunn is what I'm going to call him because that's what he tells me. Every time I have a suggest, done. What about getting this guy done? Can you please text on done? I mean, during the Damon Amendola interview when I was talking to DA, he emailed every single SID in the SEC. And started the groundwork for our interviews at SEC Media Days. I'm like, you know, you might want to get a hold of Dunn.
I like McDunn. That's a good one.
McDunn. I mean, that's it. I don't know what you're going to come up with, but, you know. By the way, top of the hour text from the 256. I think Cole is the only man to ever say fishing was gross. Well, first of all, I'd have to check the tape. I don't think Cole said that fishing was gross. I think what Cole said was gross was that slack air that we had on Saturday from about 9:30 till about noon. There wasn't a breath of air. It was 93 degrees on Gunnersville. The gnats, if you're in a spot where there's just no air movement at all, the gnats will just start on you everywhere, especially if you're anywhere near any grass that's already coming up to the surface on Gunnersville. So you start getting that going on, and it gets pretty gross. I don't think he said the fishing was gross, though. I think he meant it got gross out there. It was not fun. And my partner and I were sitting on a spot. We had caught a 4.5-pounder off of and a 2.5-pounder off of. And my partner's extremely patient. I'm not. I'm milk run guy, and my partner's sit-on-em guy. You never leave fish to go find fish. Well, yeah, we haven't had a bite in 2.5 hours, so. But that's just me. All right, when we return, we'll keep this bad boy going. Jordan Bianchi's next right here. 7:30, 103.9. The Ump.